Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. Today's episode of Talk Nerdy is sponsored by NatureBox. NatureBox ships tasty and guilt-free snacks right to your door. With over 100 flavors to choose from, like chipotle maple almonds, mango orange fruit chews, and sriracha pop pops, you'll never get bored of snacking again. And you can try NatureBox for free by going to naturebox.com/talknerdy. That's naturebox.com/talknerdy. Today's episode is also brought to you by you. Thank you so much for everybody who went to my website, carasantamaria.com, and clicked on that support button. I want to give a specific shout out here to Justin DeHart from Anchorage, Alaska, and to Jeremy Keat from Etowanda, California. Thank you guys so much for your support. You use the PayPal portal there. And I also want to thank those of you who went to patreon.com/talknerdy to support the show. Specifically, I want to give a shout out to Ron Noblock for your continuing extremely generous donation. And I hope you got that package I sent you in the mail. I also want to thank Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and Chuck Pell for your continuing donations. Guys, if you go to patreon.com/talknerdy, you will see all of the current patrons, what amounts we are pulling for each episode to help support it. I think right now we're at something like $240 an episode. Thank you so much for all of you who make whatever donations you make, anywhere from a dollar on up to $20. It's so amazing. It's so helpful. And I am in the process of shopping for a brand new Electro Voice RE20 microphone. I'm so excited. And it looks like soon we will be reaching that milestone where I'll be able to buy two of them, one for myself and one for my guest, and really improve the production quality of this podcast. I'm so excited. I couldn't do it without you guys. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. Okay. Without any further ado, I've got to tell you, I'm super excited about this week's episode, mostly because the person that I interview is kind of my personal hero. I won't hold it against her that she's my hero and she's younger than me, but she's amazing. She's a rocket scientist, explorer, and a champion for women in engineering, and she was recently named one of Forbes' 30 Under 30. Here she is, Natalie Panic. Natalie, I am so excited to be podcasting with you today.
Awesome. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah. You know what? I have to say, I think, I think I can very safely say that you are my hero.
Oh, no.
So we met, a few years ago now, I think, in Canada.
Yeah.
At a conference. I've been to so many conferences in Canada. I don't remember which one we met at.
It was the Science Technology Awareness Network conference.
Science, yes. Science Technology Awareness Network, and Stan, and it was at a museum.
Yeah,
which was really fun because it was very like oriented to kids, and we got to play around in the museum after hours, which was cool. Probably the best part. And yeah, I was on a panel there with. I definitely remember Joanne Manister and Karen Bondar. They've both been guests on the podcast before, but you were a special speaker and you talked kind of about women in STEM and about rocket science and about some of the cool stuff that you have been doing in your career. And as I was reading up on you again before we sat down to podcast, I realized like that you are so, I mean, I knew you were really accomplished, but not only are you incredibly accomplished, you also have had just so much recognition. You were Forbes 30 under 30, right?
Yeah, that just happened earlier this year, which was kind of surprising and out of the blue, but really cool nonetheless.
Very, very cool. And you've also just had a lot of kind of different awards and recognitions for being, you know, a young woman who is really kind of making a splash in, I guess, the engineering and the aerospace world. Would that be the right way to characterize that?
Yeah, I think so.
So you are a rocket scientist. I mean, that's like a term that people throw around all the time. Like, oh, it's like, it's not like it's rocket science, but what you do is rocket science, which really is aeronautical engineering, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I went to school for a mechanical engineering degree in my undergrad, and then I did a master's in aerospace engineering, and I was studying in the combustion and propulsion group.
Okay. And combustion and propulsion. So combustion would be fire, yeah, and burning fuel, and then I guess propulsion is moving. It's going forward.
Yeah. So I guess the really neat thing about my career is that I've never really followed this straight trajectory. I've kind of done a lot of different things. So mm-hmm. my master's degree was studying combustion in microgravity. So getting really technical, studying laminar diffusion flames in a microgravity environment. And basically that means I was studying how flames would burn in outer space. And because I was in a lab here on Earth, we were trying to simulate a microgravity environment by creating a vacuum and burning flames in a vacuum.
Oh my gosh, that sounds like the coolest job ever. Like, I think a lot of people listening to this podcast right now are like, you just got to burn shit in a vacuum? Like, that was your job? That's so cool.
You know, it's that like hands-on experimental stuff that I find really fascinating. The ability to build things with your own hands and then run your own experiments, I think is so rad.
And where were you when you were doing this work?
That was at the University of Toronto Institute for Aerospace Studies.
Very cool. And then so that was the combustion side of things. What about the propulsion side of things?
So my focus was really combustion. It was just that was the group I fell under.
Gotcha. So when we hear about things like JPL, which is really close to where I live, it's the mm-hmm. Jet Propulsion Lab. Propulsion there literally refers to, you know, building a jet and making it go.
Yep.
Okay, that's good. That's good clarification for me. So yeah, when we were at this conference, you were talking a lot about some of your kind of, I shouldn't say later career works. You're under 30 still. You're so young, but you've accomplished so much. After you finished your degrees, you actually did some great internships at NASA here in the US. But since then, you've also been doing a lot of work with kind of the space program or the space efforts that are happening in Canada, right?
Yeah. So right now I'm working for MDA, Robotics and Automation, which is the company that built Canada Arm that flew on Space Shuttle, and then Canada Arm 2 that's on the International Space Station. So I spend a lot of my time working on space robotics, which is really cool.
That's very cool. Before you ended up in this position, had you done a lot of work in robotics with your training previous to that?
No, not at all. I mean, I had done some robotics and mechatronics work in school. And then, again, to my point of not really following a specific trajectory, I got my pilot's license and drove a solar-powered car across North America. And then the aerospace options in Canada are very limited compared to the U.S. So MDA has a great reputation for having a niche in robotics and really being innovative in the next generation of robotics. So I ended up getting a job there, and it turned out to be one of those outside of your comfort zone experiences, which I love. Mm-hmm. And you kind of just have to dive in and learn as much as you can from your peers around you.
Do you think that, I mean, what made you want to do, as you said, this kind of not very straight trajectory, but there, it does seem like there are themes to what you did. You worked on a solar car and then you drove it across North America. You got your pilot's license. Did you, I mean, when you were a kid or even now, do you have a goal? Did you have a goal of actually growing up to be, you know, a space lady? Did you want to be an astronaut?
Yeah, I'm going to be an astronaut. That's still the plan. It's kind of a long-term goal, right?
Like, gotcha.
I think the odds of anyone becoming an astronaut are pretty small, and I'm just really trying to have fun along the way.
So, but the interesting thing about individuals who go to space, whether they are professional astronauts or they are, I guess, payload specialists who also travel to space, is that they come from a pretty varied background. There's some people who are physicists. There's some people, like I said, who are payload specialists. There are engineers. And then there are a lot of kind of these ex-military sort of fighter pilot types.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting to see the core group. You would think that most astronauts are like, you know, like us, like kind of nerdy science nerds. But a lot of them actually came from this world of flying.
Yeah, you know, I think there's this unifying drive for knowledge and this passion for exploration that kind of binds everybody with these diverse backgrounds. And the really cool thing about space travel and exploring the universe is that multidisciplinary collaboration really allows you to propel yourself forward, moving beyond boundaries and allowing us to develop technologies that can not only help us explore, but really help us back here on Earth as spin-off technologies.
Yeah, I mean, as an astronaut, like, you are one of very few people who have a lot of responsibility. So whether you are, you know, doing suborbital work, or you're up in the space station, or you're doing, you know, I guess I would say longer distance flights, which the hope is that we're going to start doing more of these manned flights going back to the moon or potentially even going to Mars. You're one of very few people on that crew. So you have to both do the science and you have to do the engineering and you have to be a pilot and you have to have the quote unquote right stuff. And you're right. It seems like if you come at it from a background where you've done work in a lot of different disciplines, you're definitely going to be better prepared than if you've just had this kind of singular vector that you've been on the entire time.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's that multiple perspectives that really adds value to any team, really.
Do you feel like for you, I mean, there are a lot of probably obstacles, right? You're still very young, which in a way probably isn't an obstacle. That's probably in your favor. But you also, you're a woman, A. You are Canadian, B. And as we know, I mean, I think there's been this really big kind of excitement and resurgence of excitement, especially around Chris Hadfield. He's become this like Canadian astronaut rock star that even people here in the States know about him, and they watch his YouTube videos. And he's just beloved, I think, across the world now. But probably before that point, I don't think, at least in the U.S., a lot of the a lot of kind of work that is done by Canadians was really in the public consciousness.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really valid point. And I think it's so exceptional that Chris Hadfield was able to interact with the public in such a great way that really got that interest and enthusiasm for space back and there.
How did he go about it? Like, is there an... I apologize for how naive I am about this, but is there a big Canadian space agency, or did he come up through the NASA ranks just as a Canadian citizen?
No, so there is a Canadian Space Agency based in Montreal, Quebec, and so all the Canadian astronauts will go through there. There's been less than a dozen Canadian astronauts since the beginning of the program. Only two of them have ever been women, Roberta Bondar and Julie Payette. And right now there are only currently two active Canadian astronauts, both men who probably won't fly for another 3 or 4 years.
Gotcha. So not only is it incredibly limited in scope just because there's so few people, then as we know in this industry, or pretty much across all industries, but as we know, it's a little bit worse in some of the STEM fields, there's also very few women. I mean, I think we see that problem here in the U.S. too, but at least, and yes, the odds, like you said before, are astronomical that anybody gets the ability to have basically this job that, you know, you dream of as a child. But to be a woman and chasing that goal, it's, you know, the odds are even less in your favor. And that's just like a truth, a depressing and disappointing truth, but it's a truth. So how do you deal with that? How do you push through that?
I think that's where women like you and I have such a unique and great opportunity to be sharing our love for science and technology with the next generation and really getting young women and young men excited about what you can do with technology and the positive solutions that we can provide to some of the problems that we'll be faced with today or in the next 10, 20, or 30 years. And that's why I love sharing my stories and the things that I've done and really just encouraging youth to be curious about the world around them and promoting science literacy across the population so that we can question information that's presented to us and think intelligently about the world we live in.
What kinds of things do you do in that realm? Like, I know that you've given some TEDx talks. You've, like, what are some of the, you know, fun opportunities that you have, and what are some of the maybe more unique ways that you try to get your message out?
So definitely do a lot of the speaking. I also have my blog, thepanicroom.com, where I just share like the adventures that I go on. I'm a big outdoors person. So lots of photos on there because I think photos can spark the imagination. I also do something I call Saturday Science Sessions because I love doing science experiments. And again, just taking photos and sharing and trying to get people excited through visuals.
Oh, fun.
And then...
And these are experiments that people can kind of, like, they can see you do it and then they can do it themselves?
Yeah, I mean, so many experiments are easy at-home things that you can do with basic supplies. And I think we really need to send the message about doing more of that and building and making and tinkering and playing.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And so do you find that your audience, for the most part, when you give these talks, is a big span? Like you have a lot of young women who you're trying to inspire who are maybe still in school and haven't really chosen a path yet, but you also have more of an adult audience?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what's really interesting is the number of emails I get from dads who will thank me for what I do because it gives them a reason to connect with their daughters and to do these types of science things and just let their daughters know that STEM careers are an option if they want it. I mean, not everyone is going to want to pursue a STEM career. That's okay. But it's about making the options known so that we all have the choice to pursue it if we want it.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually giving a talk, I say tomorrow as I'm recording this, but then this is going to air in like a week and a half. So I already gave a talk, I just don't remember it, in Riverside about women in STEM. It's an atheist conference or a humanist conference, but about women in STEM and kind of the leaky pipeline. And this is a common topic that people ask me to give talks about, and I'm sure it's very common for you too. And so maybe kind of exploring what some of the themes are in the talks that we give. I mean, I think one of the number one questions that people ask is like, why are there so few? What's your insight into that? Into that real, I think that's really the central question, which is why?
Yeah, so, okay, I think this is really a two-part problem. So you have the attraction problem of getting women interested in STEM fields to start with, and then you have the retention problem. So to get young women attracted to STEM fields, we can't always be talking about the challenges that exist. We have to inspire first. So I always say, if I'm going to go on a date with a person for the first time, I'm not going to tell you all the difficulties you're going to have dating me. I'm going to tell you how awesome I am first.
Yeah.
So once you get women inspired, then you have to retain them in the industry. And I think the retention issue has a lot more to do with leadership positions and work-life balance and finding a better way to manage women working in the industry.
And it does seem like there's a big difference between women and girls. Yes, we know that societally, we don't do an amazing job of inspiring and attracting women, or I should say girls, into STEM fields because it historically has been a boys' club. And, you know, the way that we market our toys and the way that we have these expectations of how girls should act. I think we do have a problem there. But I'm also very hopeful because I feel like when you look at young kids, at a certain level, boys and girls aren't that different in terms of their interest. They're all curious. They want to get their hands dirty. They're interested in science. And really what happens is I see a very big retention problem, a problem where when we're young enough, we're all into it. And then the older we get, the less the girls stay.
And, you know, I think that's such a huge result of the media in our society. Mm-hmm. I'm really a big advocate for more intelligent programming in the media, shows like your podcast or shows like in Canada we have Daily Planet, which is a science and technology based show with an amazing female host, Zaya Tong. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to move away from this era of reality television that does very little to inspire and move towards, again, this more intelligent programming where we can visually see women in science and engineering on a daily basis.
Yeah, and even I think when we talk about scripted programming, so when we get away from nonfiction or true, you know, documentary style programming, but even when we talk about fiction, like in the movies and in TV where you've got, you know, a CSI or you've got a physician or you've got, you know, a pilot or something like that, we need to see more female characters in those roles.
Absolutely. And, you know, growing up, you asked me about influences and what my long-term goals was. I used to watch on a week-by-week basis Stargate SG-1 with my mom, and seeing Samantha Carter, who was an astrophysicist in the series, and as she explored through the Stargate with her team, like, that was such a cool thing to me, and a visual representation every week of a woman in science succeeding in a leadership position.
And so it's easy for you now to look back, you know, because you're like an eloquent speaker and you're an adult and you have these insights, to look back and go like, wow, that really inspired me. And that really, you know, put it in my head that this is an option for me. But the funny thing is, at the time, like when we talk about role modeling is not something that kids are aware is happening to them.
Yeah.
Like when you ask a little girl, who's your role model? She's like, what are you talking about? Like, I just am here. I don't know. But then later on, you realize, oh my gosh, those things had like a profound impact on me.
Exactly. So what is the profound impact that women like Kim Kardashian are having on the population of young women?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that's, I think, what a lot of times people avoid. It's easy to say, oh, you know, we want to have more strong, smart women, and oh, the Kim Kardashians of the world are, you know, a bad influence or whatever. But like, really, like, we talk about that idea of influence, that idea of impact and of inspiration. And like, what is it? What are people, what are young girls gathering from that kind of role modeling? They're, I think, in some ways stepping backward into history, into more, again, submissive roles. They're stepping back into history, into gender stereotypes. And absolutely, there's nothing wrong with a girl being girly, and there's nothing wrong with a girl wanting to be a mom, or a girl wanting to do what we think of as kind of historically traditional female roles. But I don't want to see that girls feel like that's their only path.
Exactly. It again comes down to the idea of letting them know that they have options and that there are choices out there. And in the end, that choice is empowerment.
Yeah. And the truth is, you're right. They're not going to know it. They're not going to see it unless they see women who are doing it, unless those women become kind of more in front of the veil. And I think it's especially important, the work that you do, because you are so young and you're so accessible that a girl who's in maybe middle school or early high school can look at you and she can see herself in you. You're not, you know, at the end of your career talking about all of the great things that happened, but you're still in a place where you have no idea where you're going to end up, and you're still working towards that goal of being an astronaut, which is incredibly inspiring.
I think that's such a great point, like the ability to see women and your career in stepping stones and being able to visualize steps along the way and how to get there, and seeing that people who might be more advanced in their career than you are still navigating and still seeking out answers and finding out what they want to do. And that's okay.
Yeah, I think we don't do a very good job culturally also of kind of, I guess, valuing mistakes,
failure.
Failure, exactly. That's just not that we're this like American exceptionalism culture, at least here. I hope it's not as bad in Canada, but I definitely feel like there's been a lot of bleed out. Like the borders have blurred a lot in the past few decades where, and I see it not just into Canada, obviously. I see it into Europe. I see it into kind of the Western world in general. You see these kind of like negative traits that America is like offering to the rest of the world as a nice gift. I mean, that to me is a really interesting question, because I would say that probably 75% of my listenership on the podcast is is domestic, and then maybe about 25% of my listenership is international, and they're from all over. Obviously, the larger numbers are Canada, England, Australia, different English-speaking countries, but I definitely get great feedback and responses from people in the Middle East, from people in Africa, from people in places where you're like, that's so crazy that you listen to my show. That's, I mean, it makes me feel awesome. But Canada is probably number two in terms of listenership, and it makes me wonder really how different we are. Like, you have such insight into reality programming, and I always thought, like, no, they, you know, it's like nature specials and stuff on TV in Canada. Maybe that's not quite true.
No.
But even, I feel like when I was growing up, I had access, I was able to watch, like, I know it sounds silly, but that show Degrassi, that was a Canadian show. It was so much better than U.S. programming because it dealt with real issues that kids had. It was dealing with gay and lesbian issues. It was dealing with violence in schools. It was dealing with issues of self-esteem and environmentalism and suicide. And all of those things were just – and it was like a successful show, right? Mm-hmm. And we didn't have that. We didn't – we just – our programming wasn't that progressive, I don't think.
Yeah, that's interesting. Actually, there's a second generation of the Degrassi series that currently airs in Canada as well.
Really?
Yeah.
And is it still, I mean, just as popular as the first?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's, I mean, I think that's really cool because I guess it's like I have this idea in of Canadian programming as being much more progressive. And even though it actually might be much more progressive, I guess what you're saying is that it's still not where it needs to be in terms of valuing intellect.
Yeah, no, absolutely not.
Interesting, interesting. Yeah, because here, obviously, like, I work in TV. That's what I do for a living. Like, mm-hmm. Yes, I do the podcast, but the podcast is not my bread and butter. I wish it were, but it's hard to make a living as a podcaster. And so a huge part of my job is developing shows and pitching shows and going out for castings on things. And yeah, it's like you have to almost trick the networks into having educational programming. You have to kind of package it up in some sort of reality competition show or some sort of, you know, and then you like squeeze the science in. But like, heaven forbid, I would never use the word science. It's like you have to be very smart about how you even package these things, because if you're like, well, it's a science show about, and they go, I'm bored. It's so sad.
Yeah, which is why I think we need to start this revolution and mm-hmm. really, really push towards more interesting and provoking and intelligent programming that we haven't seen in the past while.
And it's funny because it does work on YouTube. It's very popular. You've got Vsauce and Veritasium and ViHeart and all of these amazing YouTubers who have huge subscription numbers, and people love to watch their, you know, their experiments and their conversations about science.
Yeah, very true. And maybe that's okay. Maybe we just need to grow the following more on YouTube. I don't know. That's a very interesting point.
Yeah, because, I mean, there is definitely a democratization there where you're not being told what you have to view. You get to choose what you have to view. You're less beholden to the advertisers. It's a different model. And so I think that you see these different audiences. And my worry has always been, though, that science programming is niche programming. I want to see more mainstream programming that celebrates science. Because, yes, there is good science programming on television, but it draws in an audience that's already interested in science.
Right.
And it would be really cool to see more stuff that's really mainstream that kind of like slides a little science in there. Or even like you said, it doesn't even have to be a show about science. A show that features scientists and engineers and mathematicians in a way that doesn't make them look crazy, it doesn't make them look nefarious, and that they're female and they're strong and they're interesting. Because again, little girls just don't have access to that. They don't see it anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is kind of a bummer, though, I have to say, that, like, I remember a while back I did this Google Analytics or Google Insights or something like that. It doesn't exist anymore, so I think it was Insights. And you could based on, I guess, your browsing history, it would give you like demographic information that it would guess that you are based on your browsing. And so it always would guess that I'm like a 65-year-old man because I am a science journalist. And so most everything I read is science. And I was thinking, like, that's a huge bummer that science almost intrinsically draws a male dominant audience.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. If you go to Discovery Channel's producer guidelines as an example, they specifically quote their audience as being a majority male between 18 and 39 years old, and that they're looking for...
Yeah, which is also kind of bullshit because their audience is a lot older than that.
Well, and that's what I mean. Like, I want the change to be at that producer level for the station to be saying, okay, we want to change our programming and start targeting this so that we draw a diverse audience into what we're offering.
Yeah, and you know what? It takes time. And it's like, I think that what we need to start doing is we need to stop reaching for the low-hanging fruit, because it's easy to, you know, what you hear all the time from producers is like, oh, well, we give people what they want. And it's like, no, you don't give them any options.
Yeah.
They have the illusion of choice. So they're watching this because it's the most compelling thing on TV, which is a huge bummer because we could be making compelling programming that also makes you feel smart when you walk away from it. But we don't. We give people conflict reality, which is like a new genre that's super gross, and I don't like it. I call it humiliation TV. And it's bad. And it's, I can't tell you how many times I go out for castings for things and they're like, well, this is the show. And then I have to be like, sorry, I don't do humiliation TV.
Yeah.
Like, even with science programming. One time somebody pitched me a show about redneck engineers. And I was like, so, okay, so they're rednecks. I don't get it. So you mean like they're Southern? And they're like, yeah, and they're making this really great stuff. And I'm like, so why are you making fun of them? And they literally didn't understand. They were like, we're not making fun of them. We're celebrating all this cool stuff. And I'm like, but the whole premise of the show is that you think that they're retarded. Like, the whole premise of the show is that you think that people in the South aren't like bright enough to, and he's like, well, yeah. This is not the direction we need to be going. It's such a bummer too, because I think then what you end up doing is you end up reinforcing stereotypes. Like, you reinforce these stereotypes that like girls don't want to get their hands dirty, or these stereotypes that like people who live in the South aren't cut out to be scientists and engineers, that that's only a coastal career, which is like bullshit. First of all, it's insane. I mean, I grew up in Texas. It doesn't really get more Southern than Texas. And Texas is an incredible engineering culture. I mean, Texas A&M is a huge university down there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, NASA in Houston is massive. And they're so, and yeah, maybe some of the engineers kind of talk like this. Doesn't mean that they're not brilliant engineers. But I think that sometimes we hold like heavy stereotypes about that stuff.
I wonder if people are afraid that science won't sell, which I don't think is the case at all. You just need a proper communicator in there to make it exciting and to make it relatable and for the public to care about what you're talking about and see why it should matter to them.
Yeah, and the truth is, historically, there hadn't been that many options. You know, when you think about it, you're like, oh, Carl Sagan was incredible. And Carl Sagan was incredible, but it was like just him.
Yeah.
And then you had Bill Nye who came out, and then now you've got Neil deGrasse Tyson. But like you and I, we run in circles where I'm like, oh my gosh, I could rattle off like 30 incredibly compelling science communicators without blinking. Like, that would all be brilliant for casting, but I just don't think that the I don't think that the programming people have caught up with that. And I think, unfortunately, there hasn't been enough translation. There hasn't been enough kind of spillover into traditional television.
Yeah.
It's also a hard job. Like, I'm going to be honest. It sucks. There are times when you're doing great. And there are times when you're like, why do I do this for a living? Like, I haven't had a paycheck in 6 months. This is impossible. So that's tough. And so I definitely am a bit envious that you both have this. Do you work full-time for the robotics firm, or are you part-time with them?
Full-time, yeah.
So you're a full-time employee, and then, yeah, so basically you don't sleep. You're like, no, how do I answer that?
It's busy. You know, I kind of have this motto that you only live once, so you might as well do it right. So I honestly try and jam as much as I can in, whether it's full-time at my day job, speaking at schools or universities or corporations trying to talk about what we need to do in STEM. And then I have this huge other love for exploration and the outdoors and camping, and trying to merge that all together is tough. But at the end of the day, you just have to do it.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that at the end of the day, too, just being yourself and just doing what it is that you do is going to be what inspires so many other people. All right, on that note, I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsor of today's episode. And hey, guys, we will be right back with Natalie Panic. I want to thank NatureBox for supporting this episode of Talk Nerdy. Visit www.naturebox.com/talknerdy for a free trial and start snacking smarter. You know that in between meals, or even with your meals, you want something to munch on, but don't you want to make your snacking count? Guys, yummy treats from NatureBox are totally satisfying, but they don't make you feel guilty afterwards. It's the best of both worlds. With NatureBox, you can choose from over 100 healthy, tasty options, and they're delivered right to your door. It's so easy. And even better, all of their snacks are made with zero artificial flavors, zero artificial colors, zero artificial sweeteners, 0 grams of trans fats, and you guessed it, zero high fructose corn syrup. So you're getting a lot of natural ingredients and you don't have to worry about what is in that package. Most important for me is that they are so yummy. I know this because I just finished my very last bag of treats and I can't wait until I get my next shipment. You hear that, NatureBox? Guys, there are dried California peaches, French toast granola. I could go on and on and on. So many good things. My current favorites are jalapeno cashews. Doesn't that sound good? All right, guys, what are you waiting for? I think I've probably convinced you at this point. If you go to naturebox.com/talknerdy right now, you will get a completely 100% free trial of amazing snacks delivered right to your door. You'll satisfy your craving in a healthy, natural way, and even better, maybe not even better, but also really cool, you will be supporting the podcast at the same time. Like I said, best of both worlds. I really don't think it gets any better than that. Amazing treats, healthy treats delivered to your door. They taste so good, and you support Talk Nerdy at the same time. So what are you waiting for? Go to www.naturebox.com/talknerdy right now. That's naturebox.com/talknerdy. We are back with rocket scientist Natalie Panic, and she has been doing some amazing work getting people excited again about careers in STEM and about really great STEM initiatives. And of course, if you don't know what STEM stands for, you probably haven't been listening to Talk Nerdy for long, but that's science, technology, engineering, and math. And so your background, Natalie, is mostly in kind of the technology and engineering side. And right now you are working in robotics. Tell me a little bit about some of the cool things that you've been doing here at this new position.
Awesome. Yeah. So when I first started at MDA, I was hired into a program called the Next Generation Canada Arm. So again, MDA was the company that built the Canada Arms. And if you're ever in Canada and look at a $5 bill, you'll see it on there, which is pretty cool.
It's so cool that you guys have science on your money.
Yeah, they
do.
I know.
We do not do that here.
So satellite servicing has to do with space debris and all of the satellites that are orbiting around the Earth. So we live in a world that is very satellite dependent. Technology that we use on a regular basis, whether GPS, checking weather, satellite TV, satellite radio, all require satellites orbiting around the Earth. Unfortunately, when satellites are launched into orbit, they're designed to operate for a certain number of years for their lifetime.
Okay.
So there's three things that can happen to a satellite at the end of its lifetime. It can either remain in its current orbit, it can be moved into what they call a graveyard orbit if there's enough propellant left on board, or after a number of years, it will eventually deorbit and burn up in the Earth's atmosphere. So we have a bunch of satellites orbiting around the Earth that are no longer operational. So maybe they've run out of fuel, or there's parts on the satellites that have broken down.
Okay.
And the company I work for decided to take this history of robotics that assembled space station, deployed payloads from the space shuttle, and translate it into making broken down satellites reusable again. So sending a robotic arm up on some side of sort of servicer craft, like an orbital tow truck. Mm-hmm. It would dock with a satellite that's broken down or has run out of propellant, and then the robotic arm would refuel it just like you refuel gas in your car, or it would fix or change out parts, and then the satellite would be able to function again.
And is that something that would be completely automated, or is it something where you would kind of drive it back from mission control?
So the testbed that we built, so we actually mm-hmm. have a ground testbed in our office in Toronto, would be run by a ground operator. So you'd be commanding a robot in orbit by someone here on Earth.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And
that's so cool. So you get to be a robot driver.
Exactly. You get to play with robots.
And so this thing is basically a service robot that goes up into orbit and docks with the space junk, which is right now space junk because it's not functional, but hopefully making it less junky and more functional. So what would happen to the actual servicer? Does it then itself become space junk?
So it would be designed to service a number of satellites in one go. Mm-hmm. So yeah, eventually probably itself would become space junk, but then at the same time, you would have been giving life to a number of other satellites.
Interesting. So do you know what percentage of what's up there right now is like functional?
So I believe there are 1,200 or so, that's a rough guess, operating mm-hmm. satellites.
And 1,200 or so operating. Okay.
And non-operating, I don't know off the top of my head. I have a very good infographic, if I could find it.
We'll keep talking until you do. No, thank you for looking that up. That's amazing. Because it seems like, you know, we see these artist concepts. It's very hard for us to visualize because these things are very small, but there's a lot of stuff up there. Because every time, right, there's an impact or a collision, something that's one piece becomes two, something that's two pieces becomes four. And when we talk about space junk that's fully not functional, like stuff that's been up there for a long time now, it's really starting to fill up this orbital space, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, so I found this infographic.
Okay.
There are more than 21,000 objects the size of a screwdriver.
Uh-huh.
There are 500,000 objects the size of a marble.
Wow.
Tens of millions of pieces that are paint chip sized.
That's insane. And something as small as a paint chip can cause serious damage to a functioning satellite.
Yeah, because of the speed that it's traveling at. So let me give you kind of an analogy for satellite servicing, okay?
Okay.
Imagine it's a beautiful sunny day. You're driving down the highway in your dream car. Windows mm-hmm. are down, the radio is off, you're singing along, and then all of a sudden, putt, 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 your car stalls in the middle of the highway. You go to grab your cell phone to reach for a tow truck, to call for a tow truck, and then you realize that it will do you no good because this car cannot be serviced and it cannot be refueled. So when you bought it, you signed on the dotted line that it was good for one use only. So
uh-huh.
because I'm exaggerating, imagine that your car lasts for a long period of time, say 10 mm-hmm. years, because it's an investment. So now your dead car can't be fixed. It's broken down in the middle of the highway, clogging a valuable transportation network. You didn't even have time to move it into the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of sounds ridiculous. Like you would never buy a car that you can't refuel or that you can't fix a broken part on because it's expensive and because it's not good for the environment. But that's exactly.
Well, and you know what? It's you know what it really is? It's because it's inconvenient. I think that the reason that that's not how we design cars is because we share the roads. And I think that when we first started thinking about satellites and we first started thinking about putting stuff into space, we were like, yeah, but we don't live up there.
Exactly. Just throw that up there. Whole sight unseen idea mm-hmm. that you touched on before. Like we can see the effects of what that would have here on Earth, but because we don't see that, it's hard for us to imagine the impact that it would have on us. But we're also living in a a world that is very data driven and technology dependent, and it's only going to get worse. And we can't just keep launching satellites in orbit to keep meeting a growing demand. At some point, we're going to have to be more responsible about what we're launching into outer space and start thinking about what I call sustainable exploration.
Yeah, being able to think about how do we either fix these things or how do we repurpose them. I mean, I had a guest on the podcast, Costa Gramatis, who had he's had a few different ventures, but one of the venture that he was so excited about early on was that he wanted to basically crowdfund to buy an old satellite that was kind of not good enough anymore for the purposes of this like major telecommunications firm, but would be totally good enough to help give people internet in places where they don't have access and they don't have infrastructure. And that kind of repurposing for good could change the world.
Yeah, exactly. And there's so many different ways that you can go about this. I mean, we talked about the robotics that I'm working on to use a robotic arm to refuel a satellite. But then you have organizations like the European Space Agency who are trying to develop tools as part of what they call the Clean Space Program, where they basically grab onto a dead satellite and move it into an orbit so that it starts to deorbit back into Earth's atmosphere faster and they get it out of the way. Then you have the organizations that are talking about building space nets so that they can go and capture all the small debris in a net. Like, there's so many different avenues you could go down to making this a reality. And I think I'm going to tie this back into the women in STEM discussion. It comes back to having more diverse perspectives working on these problems that require innovative solutions and collaborating with a wide background of people that can make this possible.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I was very lucky when I was young because my parents pushed me a lot in academia, and they kind of pushed me ahead a little bit. And because of that, I was in a position. I also went to a school in a very good school district. So I, even in public school, I was able to be involved in a lot of like gifted and talented programs. And I remember at 7, 8, 9 years old doing these like major national competitions. We had something here in the States called Odyssey of the Mind. We had something called Future Problem Solvers. And some these issues, it's so funny, these were some of the competition questions that we as 9-year-olds were tasked with trying to answer. Like, there's a bunch of space debris. How do we take care of it? Or we want to go to Mars, but we can't breathe just walking around on Mars. So how do we build a functional, sustainable kind of colony there? And it's so funny that these issues are issues that span a lifetime. And they're issues that when you ask a little kid, they have these very creative and innovative and interesting responses. And to your point, I think when we get comfortable and we've been on a linear track our whole lives and we're in only a boys' club or we're only hanging out with other white upper middle class people or whatever the case may be, the perspectives become so limited. And that creative process of looking at a problem from a different angle kind of goes out the window.
Yeah, I always say that multidisciplinary collaboration is the key to innovation.
And definitely multidisciplinary collaboration with multi-ethnic, multi-age, and multi-life experienced people. You know, somebody who grows up in a privileged situation, being privileged is not causally related to them being somehow unable to, solve problems in a certain way. But somebody who grows up in a privileged situation and then somebody who maybe grows up in the inner city who had to solve problems in a totally different way, if they're on the same team, they're going to be able to cover more ground.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we just forget that. I think we want like a cookie cutter society. I think that we have these weird singular goals that it's hard for us to accept the fact that people who are not like us can make us better at being us.
Yes.
So we're starting to run a little low on time. I'm sure for you, you're on the East Coast in Canada, so, or at least in the eastern portion. Are you on the coast? Where are you? Are you in Toronto?
Yeah, I'm in Toronto.
Okay, yeah. So you're like far east, and you it's late there. And for me, it's Friday right now when we're recording, and I do with the Nerd Brigade, which is a group of friends of mine. We do some work at the Natural History Museum. We do a science salon the first Friday of every month at First Fridays, which is a cool, fun thing. If you're ever in LA, come to First Fridays. First Friday of every month, it's really fun. We have speakers, and there's like a band and bars and stuff. A lot of fun. So I have to run to that. But before we go, well, first of all, I just want to thank you for making this happen, because I've wanted to connect with you again since we met now a couple years ago, and have you on the podcast, because I just think you're the bee's knees. And I know that I'll be getting that feedback from dads who are listening to the show. But also, before we go, I want to ask you the same two questions that I ask everybody who I have on the podcast. I like to close the podcast because I think it's really insightful to hear what different people have to say. And so those questions are, one, when you look to the future, what is kind of most disconcerting to you? What keeps you up at night? But then on the flip side of that, looking to the future, what are you most excited about? What fills you with optimism?
I'm going to answer the second question first.
Okay.
What fills me with optimism is, in the social media realm, seeing all of the other young women who want to be astronauts and who have set out these Mars or bust campaigns to be the first woman to set a foot on Mars. And I think that is totally brilliant.
And I love it.
And then I think what is most disconcerting to me is living in an age where we are, again, so technology driven, but I think we're technology dependent, not technology savvy. Mm-hmm. And I would rather see a world where, again, we're promoting science literacy and understanding how technology works and really taking the time to think about how the technology we're using functions, not just looking at it superficially on the surface.
And there's so many cool new things, cool new inventions and technologies and even toys out there. I recently had a chance to visit Little Bits. Have you heard of Little Bits?
Yeah.
They're so freaking cool. If you guys haven't heard of Little Bits, check them out online. It's this really cool way to like democratize understanding electrical engineering a little bit more, because it's a way that you can build circuits without having to have a lot of the kind of foundational background knowledge, and you don't have to know how to solder, because they're these little units that all snap together with magnets, and you can build amazing stuff with them. Like, really, they showed me how to make an SMS doorbell. So basically, you put this doorbell outside of your door, and when somebody rings it, you get a text message.
Nice.
It's so cool. And they have these kits where you can buy them online, and you can like build that stuff yourself. And that kind of a thing is, I think, what's missing, you're right, from our culture, is that I have this laptop in front of me. I have my iPhone in front of me. I use this stuff all the time, and I don't know how it works. And that's a problem.
It is a problem. Just like taking that 2 seconds to think about how it works. And we have Google and the internet at our disposal where you can find those answers. You can ask those questions.
Yeah. And we just don't. It's a bummer. We need to, I think we need to be more inspired, and we need to slow down a little. And that kind of would help us with that too. I feel like we've lost it's been so easy for so long that we've kind of forgotten that this is like freaking amazing.
Yeah.
Can you hear that? My dog is like scratching on the floor. You could hear that, couldn't you? All right, killer. Okay, I'm about to go. So, hey, thank you so much for joining me and for talking nerdy with me. Before we sign off, why don't you let everybody who's listening know where they can read your blog, how they can find you, on social media, and how they can get in touch?
Oh, right on. I'm so excited to be on the show. Thanks so much for having me. You can follow me on Twitter at NMPanic or at my blog, thepanicroom.com. Don't panic if you can't find it. Was that nerdy?
I love it. You're adorable. and of course, for everybody, you are already saw her name when you clicked on the link to download the episode, but it's Panic, PANEK, right?
Yeah, you got it.
Okay, awesome. All right, well, Natalie, thank you for joining me, and everybody out there, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm looking forward to the next time we get together to talk nerdy.